This evening we have a subject that is almost certain to become controversial. So I'm going to ask you to think as quietly and carefully as you can and see if perhaps some of the points that I want to make are really more obvious than you might first imagine. We must give a certain background to this discussion because actually most of our concepts of demonism, black magic, witchcraft, and diabolism belong to long traditional concepts and beliefs which have endured in our way of life over thousands of years. First of all, I think we should make one rather important differentiation. Most of the demons of antiquity were comparatively respectable creatures. The ancients believed that there were in nature spirits both good and bad. Good spirits they called gods, or in nature worship, kami, or elemental beings. Evil spirits they regarded as more spiteful and malicious by their natural intention. And these two orders of invisibles were used to explain a variety of natural phenomena. When things went well with man, he was grateful to his gods. And when things went badly, he propitiated his devils. For he assumed at an early time, and apparently quite sensibly, that God and the subordinate deities that attended the Supreme Being could not be the cause of evil. Yet as a mortal physical creature, man experienced certain disasters which he called evil. He found himself plagued with circumstances destructive to his happiness, his health, and even his life. He had to explain how it was that a good God ruling over a good world could produce destructive situations. To meet this need, orders of beings subordinate to deities, but still by nature malicious, were conjured into reality. Perhaps man copied this concept in turn from his own associates in this world. He discovered what we all find, that some of our associates are nice people, and some prove treacherous or destructive. Some of our friends are faithful and others faithless. It appears that certain phases or aspects of our way of life are protective and others are destructive. And today we explain these differences on moral or ethical or cultural or legal grounds, but still we are faced by these two parallel lines of occurrences, one helpful and the other hurtful. Going back over the history of primitive demonism, we note that nearly all of the so-called destructive forces were regarded as entities in themselves. They were sprites or mysterious little beings of nature capricious and malicious. But they operated almost completely according to their own natures. They afflicted or burdened people because apparently they enjoyed doing these things. Irish folklore is full of mischievous beings who seem to like to play pranks on innocent mortals. Most of these older demons, therefore, were an order of life, just in the same way that the various Greek divinities originated in some region of their own, had their own way of life, and only occasionally came into contact with mankind. This contact could also often be altered. Malicious spirits could be made at least temporarily friendly by offerings and by various gifts and by propitiations, as they were called. It did not seem to occur to these older peoples that these spirits were other than what they seemed to, be, some kind of a hierarchy of entities, inhabiting their own worlds and coming in contact with man only on very rare occasions. The second type of spirit that was regarded as hurtful or harmful was the individual who died with great evil or great hate in his heart. If we wronged someone terribly and he died, we conceived that he might haunt us. Perhaps this haunting was mostly the voice of our own conscience. We may have realized that this person went out of this world injured by us, and that perhaps had he a survival after death, he might resent this injury and continue to avenge it from the other world as he might have liked to do it from here. So we have this kind of spirit being, the souls of the unhappy dead. This more or less exhausted the Greek concept. The Greeks were never particularly devoted to demonology. They kind of liked life. They enjoyed nature. Their religion was a rather buoyant, festive kind. They would much rather live in a world filled with good spirits than with evil ones. Our word demon, however, has been derived from the Greek. But in the Greek form, daemon, it did not signify an evil being at all. It simply represented a creature from another dimension who might have some contact with earthly affairs. Socrates had a demon, according to his own records, and this was a godlike creature who warned him of impending evil and harm and protected him on many occasions through life. So the Greek concept of the daemon was very little different from their concept of the demigod, except perhaps that the daemon was a little more available, was present upon requirement more definitely and more consistently. We have practically no records among the Greeks, for instance, that they ever tried to use one of their spirits to harm any other person. These spirits were protectors and guardians and friends, but there were orders of spirits that were by nature inclined to be malicious or meddlesome, but the Greeks generally handled those rather successfully by putting out a little bowl of food or offering a prayer or making some little promise that they would do a favor for the spirit if the spirit would be kindly to them. It was rather a childish state of affairs and never got very much beyond that point. Among Oriental nations, there is an elaborate study of demonism of all kinds. But I rather suspect that we have been somewhat over-influenced by missionary reports. I think the demonism of Asia was very much like that of Greece. I know that today, in Asiatic countries, there is very little fear of evil spirits. Even where they are believed in, they are not regarded as being particularly dangerous. Japan has its little oni, its little goblins. But if you want to get goblins out of the house for the year, all you have to do is throw some beans at them at the Setsubone Festival, and they depart for the rest of the year. They're really not very tenacious or especially difficult. I saw a book of Japanese paintings not long ago called Recreations of Hell. It was a delightful little thing which would indicate that the Oni, or spirits, were more or less unionized or something of that nature, and that in their spare time they went fishing, had picnics, and gathered in some quiet bamboo grove and drank sake together. This seemed to be about their principal activity. Now, in almost all countries where Buddhism has been introduced, we have the same consistent story, namely that the Buddhist teachers immediately converted the demons. Demons just didn't have a chance where Buddhist missionaries went out. Even in Tibet, when Padmasambhava converted the country, he converted all of the evil spirits, and they all became good Buddhists, and they became servants of righteousness ever after. The only function that was left to them was the right to just groan and grumble a little bit and perform just a few little examples of their powers in order to sort of frighten people back on the straight and narrow road again. They became helpers whose only remaining function was to warn people against being bad. Now, this situation also seems to follow in many other parts of the world. China is supposed to have had more demons than all the firecrackers in Asia could frighten away. But again, these demons did not seem to be particularly ferocious. We have many representations in painting and carving of the most horrible scenes of demons punishing lost souls, but no one really seemed to pay much attention to it, and there's no indication that it improved the virtue of the people to any appreciable degree. These ideas just didn't sink in. The native attitude just was not appropriate to it. The general way of life was essentially, well, you can't say happy exactly, because many of these people were miserably underprivileged. At least we may say that the general temper was optimistic. People wanted to believe that good things would happen not only in this world, but the world to come. And they also had a deep conviction that whatever their religion was, that their prayers and their mantras and their various teachings would insure them against being very deeply plagued by any sinister force. In none of these older countries do we find a kind of demonism in which the demon can stand against God. There is no possibility of rebellion on this level. The demon is a nuisance, principally, represented as perhaps having some minor right to plague unfortunate humans, but even the demon himself rather inclined to repent of his evil ways and depart with very slight encouragement. Actually, I think the Chinese, most of these people, were more afraid of ghosts than they were of demons. Our philosophy in the West, however, seems to have from the beginning developed a rather neurotic attitude on this subject. In both the Old and New Testament, demonology seems to play a very real and significant part. And then as we went along through time, particularly in the Dark Ages, demons became very terrible sources of negative belief. They plagued everybody. The early Christian missionaries enlarged the population of the infernal region by populating it with all the pagans and all their divinities. This made it a rather congested area. Furthermore, the early church developed some very aggressive attitudes about how easy it was for a human being to lose his soul. He hardly had to do anything except miss one mass, and he was in trouble. Evil was ever nigh unto him, as St. Paul tells us. And he meant it. And he meant it very literally. And because of this, we see in Western civilization, all the way from the Mediterranean to Ireland, and all the way from the southern tip of Sicily to the most Nordic lands, this very great fear, this almost neurotic pressure in which the individual lived in an almost constant terror of some weird and terrible force. Here again, however, most of the pattern was firmly set upon what might be called demonism in its classical sense. The demon punished sin. The demons didn't bother good people. They had no reason to. But they had a strange and immediate power over sinners. It would almost seem as though deity had assigned them the right to do this. That whenever a person broke the good rules, he was subject to the punishments and afflictions and burdens that the demons would administer as the agents of divine wrath or punishment. The church, however, had its ups and downs on the subject of demonism. Altogether, I think we can say that the general trend of early Christianity was against demonism. It existed very strongly in local areas. It raised considerable trouble and confusion from time to time. But every once in a while, something that was either common sense or a clearer vision of things would always step in and clear the situation for a while. I think that we can say that the demonism, as it was popularly practiced even in Europe, was never really according to the church canons. It was simply something that local peoples, especially the ignorant, the peasants, and the fearful, the neurotic, the psychotic, developed, and which the clergy in turn tried to exorcise with holy water and church candles. The attitude was periodically to clear this atmosphere and to not allow the concept of demonism to build too strongly in early church history. Wherever it did build, wherever we had waves of this, we had also waves of incredible cruelty. We had horrible disasters, largely the result of morbid imagination. Now, every nation, every people of the world has produced neurotics of some kind. They're an inevitable part of life. Certainly, they are more abundant where the pressures of life have a tendency to become abnormal. But there's always someone to whom healthy, natural, optimistic matters have no meaning. There are always people who live and brood and feel and fear and worry and hate and fuss and maintain jealous, negative attitudes toward each other. Such persons have always existed everywhere in the history of our race. So, there have always been psychotics. And today, the psychotic presents very much the same problem that he did 3,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. The difference now is that he is operating against a background that is not nearly as credulous as it was in the early times. When a psychotic today sees horrible and destructive visions, this doesn't become the basis of another witchcraft outbreak. It simply now means that this person is judged to be mentally ill. A few hundred years ago, he was not so judged. He could be taken to the steps of the church and exorcised. If he did not recover, he might be subject to torture. If he still did not mend his ways or repent his claims or pretensions, he might well be burned at the stake. This situation does not hold today because we simply have a different attitude toward it. But back 1,500 years ago, when Europe was comparatively illiterate, when almost nothing was known of mental medicine, the hysterical person, the unbalanced individual, the psychotic, was an object of the greatest fear. In different areas, of course, this also differed. Among the Greeks, an insane person was said to be under the protection of the gods and was therefore never injured or bothered in any way. But in Europe during the Dark Ages, any person mentally unbalanced was assumed to be possessed of an evil spirit. Something had to be done to get this evil spirit out. And as we know, in most psychotic cases, there is a distinct lowering of the ethical moral threshold, the individual becoming abusive and profane and even animalistic. As a result of mental sickness, it is easy to understand why older nations felt that this person had suddenly become inhabited by some very low and malevolent being. We don't want to labor this phase of the matter too much, but we do know that in the subconscious of our people, in the subconscious of the race, all these old beliefs still lurk. We are, even now, unless we are completely materialistic in our attitudes, a little inclined to wonder, to question, to suspect that perhaps some of these old beliefs had validity. Perhaps somewhere around there is something that does have a forked tail and horns that might cause embarrassment at some moment. This belief, because it has come down to us, and because it has survived in many primitive areas of society, even today, requires or suggests considerable thought. First of all, we know that in modern society, demonism, as it was practiced or held to be true in ancient times, is now almost totally reserved to so-called backward peoples. It is still largely found in isolated, underprivileged areas. It is found among people who are comparatively illiterate, whose advantages in life have been few, who have been strongly introverted into patterns in which their tribe or their family or their community has been spirit-ridden and ghost-ridden for ages. It does not appear too often in what might be termed a level of higher mental attainment. It is limited to primitive areas, which should give us some idea as to the real state of the matter. Now, in more modern times, during what has been called the Middle Ages, there appeared another problem that really does not stem from real, honest, good old-fashioned constructive demonism. It is a different brand of this belief, and it has been called diabolism. And diabolism, or black magic, as it has gradually come to be known, indicates or holds the concept that of two things. First, that evil spirits naturally existing can be controlled or brought into the service of a magician, as in the case of Faust, and that this evil spirit will do the bidding of his master for a certain length of time, sign a pact with him, perhaps sign it in blood. In the European museums and libraries, there are a number of these original pacts, neatly signed in blood. These pacts bound an evil spirit to man for a time. Usually, the pact ended by the evil spirit receiving in payment the soul of the magician. This is the classical pattern and is found in many old works on demonology. But during the duration of the pact, this demon was forced to serve his master, to do anything that his master wanted him to do. Now, in a great many of these old books, we find a very interesting line of thought, which seems to indicate that the demonism actually did arise from older beliefs. For we learn that these demons that were bound by pacts really had no interest in hurting anybody. They were not out trying to make the magician do evil things. Mephisto did not have the slightest interest in advancing the whims of Dr. Faust. Mephisto lived in an entirely different kind of world of his own. As the demon, he represented a debonair personality, worldly wise, sophisticated, and attained in all things. To him, Faust was no one but a child, an infantile ignoramus, perfectly willing to sell his own soul for a few years of glory and a little wealth or the fulfillment of his own desires. And as Mephisto himself tells us, he hasn't the slightest interest in Faust's desires. But because of the pact, he is his servant for the duration of the bargain and must do as he is told. In fact, in a few instances, Mephisto actually intercedes and strongly recommends that Faust not do some of these evil things, which are senseless, meaningless, and purposeless. So in the demonology, it wasn't a case of a demon taking great joy in injuring people. It was a bored demon who had no interest in humanity, who didn't care whether humans lived or died, because he was no part of them, they were not his region, they were not his world. But he had made a bargain, he had signed a contract, he was, so to say, an apprentice to the sorcerer for a while. So he did what he was told and waited patiently until he could inflict final punishment upon the sorcerer himself. This type of diabolism, again, doesn't quite meet the thinking of most people of today. Because here, and this was the typical demonism of the crossroad, where the magic circle was drawn, where the witches of Macbeth brewed their cauldrons, all of this type of medieval tying of spirits, the binding of the powers of nature to the whims of a human being, all of these were based upon a certain power process. There were secret words, there were secret conjurations, magic circles and terms, rites to be performed. And if the magician was able to perform these correctly, he could command the spirit. And if he could command the spirit, then the spirit had to obey him. And the spirit felt really, as several of the old accounts say, one or two of the spirits do, like Asmodeus in one of the early books, says to the conjurer who has called him out of the misty deep for some nefarious undertaking, "Why have you disturbed me? I have no reason to be here. I don't care anything about you. I don't want to hurt anybody. Why have you bothered me? Why have you said these words of power that now force me to obey you? Because you have the magic talismans, the magic symbols. Why have you done this to me? I don't dislike you. I haven't done anything to you. Why do you insist on binding me to some common human purpose of your own?" This was the rather nonchalant idea. It seems to have carried through from the Greek, in which these spirits were simply part of the citizenry of an invisible empire and really would never bother anybody if humans left them alone. Now, the next phase of the situation takes on a little different coloring. As the result of the binding of spirits by these conjurations and these magical formulas, it came to be believed that human beings could hurt each other. This was a very late development in the idea of demonology, that human beings should want to use evil forces to afflict each other. This was not part of the original concept at all. Ghosts might haunt those who hurt them in life, but not innocent people. And in most countries, the ghost is a kind of a wavering symbol floating in the atmosphere in graveyards at night or something, but not inclined to do anything more than be there, although its presence might frighten some superstitious person out of his wits. But it was not really any particular idea. The concept that either evil wanted to conquer good or could conquer good came late. The idea that man might want to use evil, some kind of an invisible or magical evil, to hurt other people, this was simply not part of primitive ethics in the majority of instances. It arises occasionally, but is certainly of the exception rather than of the rule. But once we began to believe in witchcraft, once we believed that human beings could make pacts with demons, or could develop within themselves some evil force, could pervert their own natures, and begin to burden us with their perversions, like the witches of Europe riding on their broomsticks to the Sabbat on the Brocken, human beings themselves voluntarily and of their own inner conviction chose to become evil, chose to hurt or destroy other people, and sought in long and difficult processes to discover means by means of which they could bewitch or haunt or in some way from a distance plague or hurt normal, innocent folks. Antiquity had very little room for this concept because it simply did not believe it. It believed that the so-called spirits could exist. It believed that evil people could do evil deeds. But it simply did not develop any strong concept of black magic as we think of it today. It was outside of the grand concept of life which these people held, and they would not permit something to be believed that did not fit into the great theory of the kind of world they lived in. And with the exception of very primitive people, there was no general group in society that believed that the world was created for the purpose of perpetuating evil, or that evil had any chance of conquering good in the long, difficult picture of things. Even in the Mazdean faith, evil had no real power to ultimately achieve victory over good. Good was real. Good was deep and great. Evil was passing. Evil was linked so closely to the infirmities of men that it became more and more obvious that most of the evil that we have attributed to demons really arises in the nature of man himself. That we are the creatures who seem to possess the strange power of being malignant in some way, malicious, malevolent in our conduct towards other people. So in the most part, we come down to comparatively modern times, bringing with us all the grimoires of old, the ancient books of magic and spirits, the pentacles and talismans of Agrippa, the old book of the keys of Solomon the king. We have all these beliefs that have been shadowed down through time, books that have to do with the creation of an empire of sorcery, a sorcery in which all of the common good of life is threatened and the universe is placed at the disposal of the sorcerer. If he can become wise enough, if he can become strong enough, if he can become skillful enough, there seems to be no limit to what he can do to ordinary, well-intentioned, God-fearing people. This concept has lingered on, however, in an extraordinary way. And unless we begin to think it through somewhere, we have to face it more frequently than perhaps we like to really imagine. Even in our most sober moments, we are afraid that somewhere around us, somewhere in space, are powers of evil. That these powers of evil, operating upon us from the invisible, or coming into focus here through persons of evil nature, that these forces can do us great harm. We have also come gradually to lack the marvelous solutions that ancient people had. Most of the time now, the solutions which took care of everything 500 years ago just do not seem to be adequate anymore. We are too smart to believe the solutions, but we are not smart enough not to believe the original idea. In other words, we are foolish enough to believe in these evil principles, but not wise enough or not gullible enough to believe in the simple remedies that always took care of them satisfactorily up to recent times. In those long periods in which we were either blessed or cursed by the lack of psychiatrists, these things more or less took care of themselves. Every community had its own local psychiatrist in the form of an elderly widow or someone of that nature, preferably the seventh daughter of a seventh daughter born with a veil. If we could find her, everything would work out. But how did it work out? Just as it works out in the reservations of Indians down in our New Mexican and Arizona areas today. If you think there is an evil spirit that is trying to do you a little harm, you have to find two stones of a certain shape and size, tie a piece of wool around the stones, and carry them in a little pouch in your pocket or on your body. If you have made this little talisman correctly, you have nothing more to worry about. You're in the clear as far as affliction of that nature is concerned. If you're bewitched, all you have to do is wear your coat inside out for a couple of days, and it's taken care of. These things certainly cause no more trouble. If it's too bad and you just can't handle it yourself, you go to a bruja, which is another witch, and you pay a very reasonable sum for the second witch to bewitch the first one, and then you go home and take and go on with your affairs as always. There was always such nice, easy ways out. In the medieval period, all you had to do was confess, do a penance, and be sprinkled on with a little holy water, and the situation was reasonably well in hand. We still have the fears and the worries, but we've lost confidence in the remedy, and that is a rather sad state of affairs, because we now have no way of getting ourselves out of these attitudes. Once we get into them, it becomes a deep and involved and troublesome process. We just are a little less optimistic about how to cure our own infirmities. Perhaps too much dependence on the professional level of things. The point to be very definitely made is this, that as time went on and down into the 20th century, we have a kind of black magic that has drifted along, that has taken on, in some instances, a rather respectable and sophisticated look. The old sorcerer with his pointed cap and long black robe covered with stars has vanished. We have now what might almost be termed the mental magician. He has taken the place of all these other things. But we do still believe that people exist who want to hurt us. We also believe that there are certain persons who can hurt us. And whether this hurting is done by means of chaining a demon, or whether it is done by the natural orneriness of the magician himself, makes very little difference to the sufferer. He actually believes that he is in constant psychic or spiritual danger due to the malicious intent of someone else. Now, that this should be a belief is quite understandable. Our so-called level or veneer of sophistication is pretty thin, and beneath the surface of our so-called mental advancements and attainments, there is still very much of the primitive and very much of the frightened. We all live very largely influenced by fear. And fear is a mysterious thing and is most deadly and most dangerous when the object of that fear is most difficult to isolate or distinguish. Blind fear is the most terrible thing of all, because there's no way you can open your eyes for it. It is simply there as a terrible compulsion to terror within yourself. And nothing that man has ever developed in the form of sophistications apparently can touch this basic atavistic anxiety which is within him. So we are all born with it. We all have to struggle with it. And we all have to solve it much as we solve every other problem in life. Mostly by common sense. Also by building positive beliefs or convictions that are larger than the negative ones. If we would sit down quietly by ourselves, perhaps, and think some of these things through, we would be forced to make decisions. But by the time we are thoroughly frightened, we are in no mood to make decisions. The immediate terror is greater than any judgment that we can be expected to focus on the situation. So the same problem that answers ignorance in every other form must be applicable to this form. The only answer lies in the individual developing within himself positive resources, resources of understanding and insight that simply will not permit him to take on negative and essentially destructive attitudes. And whenever in the history of civilization, men have followed strongly after constructive beliefs, demonism has faded out. Whenever these beliefs were themselves compromised and men fell back again upon their terrors, demonism increased again. Therefore, we are reasonably certain that wherever the individual does develop inner resources, he is able to protect himself far better from blind fears. I think that in this particular problem, of course, philosophies such as the Platonic philosophy of Greece and the Buddhistic philosophy of India are of the greatest practical help. Because the individual, if he has some kind of a basic philosophy upon which he can lean, will have a tendency not to fall so quickly into a completely chaotic and unphilosophic point of view. Most students, for instance, of mysticism, metaphysics, and esoteric sciences and arts in the United States now in this century believe essentially in a universe that is ruled over by proper, orderly laws. Most mystics and most of those persons who by nature and temperament might possibly come under the pressure of too much belief in invisible forces in life, most of these people claim sincerely that they believe in a good God. They claim one of two things, either that God is good, or if they're rank materialists, that God does not exist. And if God does not exist and there is no purpose to the universe, then we have no reason to suppose that evil exists either, because if there is any enduring principle, there is no doubt from all of our observation and reflection for thousands of years that this principle is essentially good. So if we believe, for example, as in Platonism and Buddhism, that this universe is the product of a divine mind, that this divine mind of itself is inevitably and eternally good, and by the very nature of itself produces out of its own nature only good. If this universe, therefore, is a product of divine consciousness, and is ruled over by just laws, where in all the heaven and earth of justice is their place for psychic plaguing of one person by another. Something has to be wrong in the picture somewhere. If a person is subjected to psychic malpractice, which he hasn't earned, which he doesn't deserve, and for which he has no way of protecting himself reasonably, and he must endure this because some other person wishes to take advantage of him, and the one person is not punished for his evil, and the victim is not protected against this evil, what happens to the concept of universal law and order? Well, the answer of the afflicted person usually is that the universe of law and order is a long way off, somewhere in space, and the difficulty of the moment is right here. And this is considered to be irrefutable. But the more we think about it, the more we realize there has to be something wrong with the picture. We have to realize that if it were true that by means of the faculties that we are normally endowed with, we are capable of exercising extraordinary malicious influence over other minds. If it is possible for a mind, for good or for ill, to control the life or destiny of another human being, simply because this mind is stronger and the other mind is weaker, and the weaker mind has no defense whatever, we would be in a situation in which the whole world could very well become involved in what might be termed psychic warfare. We would have no out for this situation. In the 1940s, there were probably 300 or 400 million minds. Strong minds, many of them. Minds of persons horribly hurt and injured. Millions of persons going out like the haunting ghosts of antiquity, with all his hatred headed straight at one man, Adolf Hitler. And yet it took the combined armies of the Western powers to finally bring this man to his end in a bunker in Berlin. He was under the most terrible mental pressure imaginable. I personally know individuals who claim to be well up in magic, who are working night and day to destroy him by magical means. All he did was take on some more territory and take another nation over. Hundreds of millions of minds with just cause for the greatest hatred. Didn't get very far with him. What finally got him was himself. The same might be true of Mussolini. The same was certainly true of Joseph Stalin. The probabilities are that almost as great an amount of hatred was turned against Wilhelm Hohenzollern II, who passed a pleasant and quiet old age in Holland. Why? If one individual can, by means of mental suggestion, destroy my life or your life, how is it that they can never seem to get the fellow that needs trouble the most? They don't get him. He keeps right on going. And the reason why he almost certainly keeps on going is because he doesn't believe that these other people can do it. He is so sure of himself. Hohenzollern with his me and God. Hitler, the man of destiny. Napoleon, the man of destiny. It was their own arrogance, their own conceit, their own stubborn unwillingness to listen to anyone else that finally destroyed them. But the sorrow, the pain, the agony of minds did not do it. the prayers lifted up against these tyrants did not seem to operate very effectively. And yet we like to assume that these same forces that cannot touch these men, even when augmented several millions of times by concerted thinking, that one lonely character of uncertain mind can destroy us. Actually, we have to reevaluate this entire situation. And it is a little difficult to do because there are things we so desperately want to believe. And there is nothing that we want to believe more than that which we see, that which we hear, and that which which occurs so directly and intimately to us that there seems to be no possible way of evading or avoiding the situation. What we see that have happened seems so factual that we cannot escape it. Now, in Buddhist philosophy, we have these repentant Onis, miscellaneous secondary demons, who more or less finally went to the robe and became good Buddhists themselves. And what do we have as the answer to the rest of the problem in Buddhism? There is one thing, and that is perhaps the most important key to all. There is one legitimate cause for the individual to be in trouble, and that is karma. Now, karma is not a monster. It is a good law, absolutely necessary to us. But like the Mio of China and Japan, the ferocious-faced deities were always smiling in a kind of a wicked, sardonic way, as much as to say, I shall have you for breakfast. These Mio, or Fudo Mio, represent karma. They represent the inevitable power of retribution. And to the Eastern way of thinking, karma is this thing which is itself a divine good appearing to us in a horrible and destructive and unfortunate and unpopular appearance. In both Platonism and Buddhism, an individual has to be in need of some type of punishment, or it doesn't come to him. He has to experience that which he has caused. Let us say, for example, that back somewhere in the Middle Ages, a second or third-rate sorcerer appeared who really believed, perhaps, that he could use these evil forces for his own advantage. Perhaps he didn't use them really for his own advantage. Perhaps he didn't even know whether he did or not. All he knew was that when he prayed that a person would die, that person would sicken and die. And it was obvious, therefore, that his prayers had done it. We know today that this does not necessarily constitute the answer, but as far as our medieval sorcerer is concerned, he may have believed it. So we might assume that all the way down through time, there have been individuals who have sold their souls for wealth, for power, for the fulfillment of their ambitions, and for the fulfillment of their appetites. These individuals have conspired against the public good. They have cheated and stolen and bribed. They have done all kinds of unpleasant things. Perhaps when they did them, they thought it was all right to do them. We've got the whole generation of people now making the most stupid possible mistakes with a very good attitude on the whole thing. I've talked to people recently who have admitted frankly that they see no reason why they should not get the last dollar they can, no matter who they take it from. The problem is now you're respectable if you get the dollar. How is no longer a problem or a question. So people compromised their principles down through time. Some did it in the name of religion. Some did it in the name of power. Some did it in the name of business. Some did it in the name of the learned professions. But they exploited. They took unfair advantage. They used knowledge and skill to hurt with. And this essentially is black magic. They used the intelligence which they had to enslave other people instead of to free them. They used their scientific skill to make objects and weapons of destruction. And we're producing a lot of them right now. But they took the God-given faculties that man has and have used these faculties to terrorize other people, to destroy the securities of living, and to leave this world perhaps a barren sphere in space if someone doesn't come along and straighten out the problem and the tangle. Now, these people, unfortunately, are subject to a law that they don't know anything about, most of them. And that is the law of cause and effect. These individuals have set up compensations. They have set up compensations not merely because they were ignorant, because nature takes ignorance into consideration. They are setting up compensations because they know they are wrong, and yet they prefer to do it that way. Every time we get mad at someone, we know we are wrong, but we keep on doing it. And after a while, we have a thrombosis, which is the way nature catches up with us. When we do what we want to, the world is wonderful, but a thrombosis is sent by the devil. We haven't realized that in many instances, the devil, which is merely a form of the deity Fudo or Yama or Mara in India, is the leering, flame-encircled image of karma. The natural ills that we have done coming back to us. But we remember the words of Mephisto in Faust when Faust asks the demon who he is. And Mephisto answers, the spirit of negation, part of the power that still works for good while ever scheming ill. This is karma. In other words, the demon is simply the long way toward the good, the roundabout way through the mistakes that man himself makes. So there is one way in which things can go wrong with us that we cannot explain. Paracelsus, who probably is accredited with knowing more about demons than any other medieval thinker, tells us that there are no miraculous circumstances in life, that a miracle is only the effect, the cause of which is unknown, but that cause must be equal to the effect that it produces. So what we term psychic persecution today is an effect. There has to be a cause for it. And where are we going to find the cause? Where in the universe can we find a just cause that something unfortunate should happen to us? The only possible answer is that the just cause has to be ourselves. There has to be a lesson which we must accept. There has to be unfinished business. When this moves in upon us, we can join the Hindus and the Romans and the medieval Christians and the Goths and the Celts in assuming that an evil spirit is bringing it in a pack on its back. But this evil spirit, so called, is nothing but the retributional aspect of universal law. A good spirit, a saintly spirit, is the spirit of the reward for good. The evil spirit is the spirit